Time for breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is a crowded table of wounded children, parents, spouses, caregivers, and weary souls. Together, we join in honest conversations about the behaviors and challenges of parenting and working with children who've experienced trauma. There's always room for one more at the table to share in the stories, science, and healing as we learn to better understand and care for each other. We are a table without shame or judgment, because life can be hard and lonely, and we all know that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. I'm Stacy. I'm a mother of 7 children and have fostered for over 13 years. As an RN and former public school teacher, I quickly realized this type of parenting was not taught in a textbook or class. Let's learn together to parent different, not harder. Welcome to Trauma for Breakfast. Welcome, welcome everyone to Trauma for Breakfast. I am your host, Stacy Gagnon, and I am with Jody Spataro today. Let me give you a little bit of background on who Jody is, but then I'm going to let her fill in all the blanks. Jody basically is a nonprofit industry leader, and she does a lot around strategic fundraising, philanthropy, nonprofit capacity building, and board governance. All of that to say, I see her as someone who is able to bring in finances to support nonprofit work. And I was laughing because just yesterday I saw a meme that was talking about what nonprofit dollars really mean, which is, hey, we'll give you 73% on the dollar of what you need in order for you to do what we want you to do. It was kind of a funny thing, but I am absolutely excited to have Jody on, not just because of her background, just that fundraising and philanthropy, but really her background in understanding early adversity and family and community and how people pour into kids and adults. Welcome, Jody.
Well, hello there. Good morning. So nice to be with you today. Thank you.
Well, Jody, give us just a rundown of who you are, because obviously I can read a bio or I can say these things, but it's not really who you are.
I love that question because you can answer that question in so many different ways, right? I've learned that when I married my wonderful husband, he grew up in New York, really kind of the Brooklyn area. And when New Yorkers ask, who are you? They want to know if you are Catholic, if you are Italian, if you are Polish, if you, what are you? But growing up in the Midwest, I've learned all my life that who are you is I'm a mom, I'm a teacher, I'm a philanthropist. Who are we? You know, we get to define that, right? So I would like to say that I am a woman of faith who has lived my life in a way to serve others because it's the only thing I know.
I love that. I love that. So just a background as a mom and a wife, tell us about your family dynamics.
Yes. So I married at a very young age. I was actually a teenage mom, had my first daughter when I technically was 20 when I had her, but was 19 when I got pregnant. I have 2 natural daughters. And as life happened, I am a divorced woman who is now remarried to I call him my a la carte man, the man of my dreams, all of the things that you want in a spouse and nothing else. And the two of us have created a beautiful blended family. And I have now 3 daughters. And again, we're a blended family. So I love it. And I am a new grandma as well. So that is probably the biggest joy of my life.
Well, congratulations on the grandbaby.
Thank you. Yeah.
Before we kind of get into some of the meat of what we want to talk about, tell me what it is that you're doing in your career right now, because you've had a pretty varied, you know, history in the nonprofit world. Tell us now what you're doing.
I am currently doing corporate philanthropy. And for the first time in 30 years, quite frankly, my entire career, I am working in a business environment, helping lead a corporation to be philanthropic, being very intentional about their philanthropy, really, truly bringing the outside in, helping improve the culture internally and bridging a gap between sales and purpose. But background, I believe it or not, I put myself through college. I worked part-time. I did a lot of corporate work then. I worked part-time at a bar, waiting tables. I did retail. I was a debt collector for a long time, so I got really good at asking people for money at a young age. So it was really easy. And then my grandmother had a diagnosis with colon cancer and went into the hospital, had surgery, had the polyps removed, and went home the next day, and she was fine. And I was like, oh, okay. I was young, and this young, naive self of mine was just like, okay, why is everybody making such a big deal about cancer? My grandma had cancer and she went to the hospital, had it removed, and was fine. At the same time, I was working in an office and my assistant manager was taking care of her mother who had breast cancer. I watched her struggle with that caregiving every day. Through that journey, I watched her pain through her lens, and we had an opportunity to participate in an event that the American Cancer Society was starting called Relay for Life. It really sort of was the bug that bit me. So my assistant manager, Kathy, ended up losing her mom to breast cancer. And shortly after losing her mom, she finally had a mammogram and was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer herself. And she knew that she had this lump during her caregiving days, but chose not to take care of herself because she was focusing her energies on her mom. And again, I equipped my energy and passion to the naive young person that I was. And I went down to the American Cancer Society office and said, I don't understand this. How can one person go to the hospital and have this cancer removed and be completely fine, and another person loses their life? I don't understand. And the director at the Cancer Society said, well, I want to take your passion and your energy, and I want you to help us spread the word about early detection and help us raise awareness about this. And I became a volunteer at the American Cancer Society and actually helped create the first Relay for Life back almost 30 years ago. And that truly is what changed my life, my career path, I would like to say, and have been in nonprofit administration, fundraising, community development ever since.
That's an amazing, incredible avenue to get to where you're at. I do know, and I'm just going to share with the audience, that when I first met Jody, I had heard about this keynote that she had given using a key, which was just a literal little metal key. And every person that was in the room was given a key. And it was a mic drop keynote. And why I wanted Jody on is because I feel like that story really drove home to me what encapsulates so much of what we talk about on Trauma for Breakfast, but also how we should be operating in the world around us, whether you're a teacher, you're a foster adopt mom, you're a police officer, or you're whatever area that you're living in and serving in. This, to me, the key analogy is just something incredibly, incredibly powerful. And so I asked Jody to come on today and share that with us. Tell us about the key.
You know, what's interesting about this, Stacy, is that I didn't tell anybody when I went to deliver this keynote. I had an idea. I was working for our local community foundation at the time. I didn't even tell my husband. I knew I was doing the keynote. Everybody knew I was doing that. But what I was going to talk about was not discussed in so many words. Our theme that year were doors. And from a donor perspective, the different doors that donors walk through to be philanthropic. And I took that the next step and had skeleton keys on all of the different tables. And what I will tell you is that when I was a little girl, the only doors that I saw were physical doors, the car door, the school door, the house, the grocery store, you know, physical doors. But what I didn't see were the other doors opening around me that shaped me into the woman I am today. What I want to share with you and your listeners today is how people in my life have seen me and created a preconceived idea of who I am. You know, they see me as this successful business, you know, nonprofit executive who has it all together and this perfect life. But how I grew up was extremely opposite. I grew up in what some would describe as extreme poverty. My mom and dad moved us every 6 months to avoid paying rent. I never started and ended school in the same building. And by the time I finished fourth grade, I had already attended 11 different elementary schools. There were many nights that I would go to bed hungry, and oftentimes I didn't have money for lunch. And when I was growing up, we didn't, at least from my knowledge, didn't have free and reduced lunches. And instead, often I was just given a peanut butter sandwich My stepfather was very abusive, and I learned at a very young age how to tell a white lie to protect my family from being torn apart. When I was 10 years old, my sister and I were placed in a home while my mom recovered from injuries suffered at the hands of our stepfather. And we lived with this woman we called Grandma Blanks. And it was only a few short weeks. But what I realized is that she opened her door to provide us a safe place to sleep and put really yummy food in our bellies. Her door gave me a glimpse into the life that was a very foreign, beautiful life to me. Grandma Blanks had two hobbies. She had miniature Victorian dollhouses, and she liked to bake chocolate chip cookies. And so she told us that we were not allowed to touch or play with those dollhouses, but instead, she made us a cookie jar and kept it stocked with freshly baked cookies. Now, you might imagine, Stacy, that going from a dry peanut butter sandwich to freshly baked, yummy, gooey chocolate chip cookies was like a child's playground. And to this day, I still find that freshly baked chocolate chip cookies brings me immense joy. And I don't really care for Dollhouse as much. But I actually learned several years later, probably more as an adult, that Grandma Blanks was a volunteer at the YWCA in Dallas, Texas. And the YWCA was the key for my mom to finally leave that abusive relationship and open a new door to a new beginning. That new beginning brought us to Mishawaka, Indiana, where we lived temporarily with my maternal grandmother. And, I would say life kind of slightly improved and moved on. I have an older sister who's very smart. And while we were in school, and when we finally were more stable here in Indiana, I found this really interesting thing that happened where I actually had friends. I finished fifth grade and started sixth grade in the same building with the same set of friends. And it was like, wow, I know you people. This is kind of weird. But when we got to high school, what happened is that my sister, oftentimes my teachers would say, oh, are you Kelly's sister? And I got so mad because I didn't want to be Kelly's little sister. I wanted to be Jody. I wanted to be my own individual person. And so I found that many times we were teaching each other to keep up with the ever-changing curriculums because we were moving around in different school systems. But she pushed me harder than probably most people would think because she was so gifted. Everything came easier. She was very, very smart. She ran cross country. And after school, I didn't have anything to do. And so I would stay at school while she was at practice. And I had an administrator from the school system named Doc Schreiner that came up to me and said, hey, if you are going to be sitting here at the school, then I'm going to give you purpose. And he basically took me under his wing and taught me how to be a student athletic trainer. If I wasn't in the classroom, I was in the training room at school, and I learned how to help kids with sprained ankles, soothe sore muscles, tape ankles before their practices and different things. And Doc Schreiner also was the first person in my life that asked me about college. We would spend hours talking about what life would look like after high school. He arranged for me to go to athletic training camps, and he took me on two college campus visits. Doc was opening doors for me that I didn't even realize. I ended up not finishing college as an athletic trainer, though, and I almost fell into the same cycle as my mom. Like I said earlier, I started my own family at a young age of 20, but that same determination that I had in high school pushed me to break the cycle of abuse and poverty as an adult. I started using the keys from my childhood to open new doors. Some people ask me how I can look back and see my glass as half full when most people see it as a half empty glass. When my oldest daughter was considering an engineering degree, we saw a t-shirt that said that engineers don't see a glass as half full or half empty. They just see the glass as the wrong size. And so I often believe that in life, things didn't happen to me, they happened for me. So I don't see a half empty or a half full glass. I just see the glass as the right size because it's what's supposed to happen for me. Everything that happened in my life brought me to you today. Our connection, Stacy, has been absolutely remarkable. And through the seeds of all of the adversity that I faced as a child, there was something planted to do something great. I know that Grandma Blanks was the person who helped me see a better tomorrow. The door may not have had a knob or hinges, but they were doors that helped me see that I can help those that are less fortunate, because she, Grandma Blanks, used her key to open a door to a whole new world to me. Her generosity, her love, her compassion provided me an opportunity to see how I can serve others. My door to reaching newer heights was large in part due to my sister, because she was opening bigger doors for herself. We had the same set of circumstances, and neither of us used them as an excuse to repeat the cycle of poverty. And I will say, I'm sorry, gosh, the biggest door that was opened for me was from Doc Schreiner, a man who didn't have to care about me at all, but he did. My life was filled with men who abused me, and so I didn't have a lot of trust for men. And Doc Schreiner was the first man that I trusted. And he was not only a mentor to me in high school, but the first man in my life to show me that how to achieve something bigger than myself was all inside me. And he unlocked that key for me. So I tell you all of this to say that my life has been filled with gratitude and giving back to this community and has opened so many new doors. And it just feels natural. We all have opportunities to open doors, whether it is through a gift, through service, through just listening. I have found that the skeleton key is such a symbol of overcoming and unlocking the potential in all of us.
I absolutely, oh, Jody, I hear all you're saying, and I think that it's like taking purpose from pain. One of the things that you said that I really keyed in on, no pun intended, learning to tell white lies in order to protect what you knew. And it's interesting. I would love for you to expand on that a little bit, because I see so many foster families or parents or being like, or even teachers saying, but they're being abused or this is happening and they still love their parents or they still, and would you explain that from a child's perspective?
Boy, I wish I could. I what I can tell you is it's so unnatural for me to think about how great of an effort that I took as a child to protect my family, the family unit that was very toxic. I remember I was in kindergarten. I mean, I can tell you every detail of the room when my mom, with tears rolling down her face, was putting on makeup on my face and saying, "Now, when you go to school, if anybody asks you about why you have a black eye, you need to tell them that you ran into a doorknob, because if anybody knows that you were hit by your dad, then, you know, they're going to take you away and I'll never see you again." So, and I said to her, "But Mama, we're not supposed to lie." And she said, "Honey, this is a white lie. This is a lie that protects your family, not hurts your family." And it was that moment that I was like, okay, well then lying is okay when it protects the people I love. And I don't know how to describe or explain why I fought so hard to stay in that family unit. I didn't know anything different. It was not, you know, it's one of those things where you don't even, I didn't even know what life looked like without that. What I was living was normal to me. And so I loved my mom. She was my protector, even when she couldn't protect herself or really us from the abuse that we were suffering. It really, truly wasn't until I saw life inside Grandma Blanks' home that I realized how terrible my living conditions were. And in some ways, because my entire family has sort of been in this cycle of poverty, it really wasn't that different. And in part of my story, you know, I tried to make it brief. You know, the abuser moved us to Dallas, away from the network, away from all of our family. And so leaving that wasn't an option. There was a grip, there was a trap in that abuse. There's also a safety. You don't know how else you're going to take care of yourself if the abuser has, it's not just physical abuse most of the time, especially for us. We were very mentally abused as well, to believe that Jerry was the only person that could take care of us. If we left, then we wouldn't have shelter and we wouldn't have clothes. I mean, we barely had food, but the food we did have, we wouldn't have. it really is this, it's unnatural.
One of the things I really key in on, and something I talk about a lot, is that there should have been no apology from you to love and protect your mom and your family. Like, that's, to me, you shouldn't need to be grateful to have Mrs. Blanks, or you shouldn't be like a child coming into my home for foster care. There should be no, I'm grateful to be here, because the reason they're there is built on so much hurt and loss and pain. And to recognize that, of course, they love their parents, right? Of course, there is that feeling, and it should be okay. Honestly, like, what I hear is the death of, in some ways, a death of your ideal and what your whole framework is for what is good. I wonder that about kids that have come in my home, that moment of realizing this is not, maybe, I don't know. That's just something I have probably carried and weighed a lot in my brain, of these kids coming in when I first started fostering, thinking like, oh, I'm going to give them all these good things and all this picture of what it should look like. Now I realize like how absolutely devastating for a kid to carry that and have to feel like they have to choose.
Yeah. I'm going to push back a little bit on a statement that you made, only because of my situation. I cannot honestly tell you that I always loved my parents, especially my stepfather. You know, when I was, my parents divorced when I was 18 months old, and we were immediately moved to Dallas. And so I didn't have a relationship with my natural birth father until I was almost, when we moved back here in Indiana. So I was, you know, a teenager. And the abuser was a man that I was told I had to love, which is also part of the hardness of breaking the cycle, because I am being forced into loving somebody that I don't love. And then that love then translates and gets copied to feel like, well, this is the only love that I know I'm supposed to feel. This is what's defined as love. And until I actually understand how my heart truly can be loved and what good, positive love feels like, I didn't know that. And there have been times that since my mom has left that abusive situation, she still continued to make very poor choices in life. Part of it is because of her cycle, because she needed to get that support. And until she actually realized that she needed that support, and she has to do that herself. I mean, my sister and I do have a younger sister as well. My older sister and I tried so hard to get my mom to stop making all of these bad choices. In that abusive situation, there was a lot of drugs. She had a strong addiction. There were many months, many years that I can honestly tell you, Stacy, that I did not love my mother. So growing up, as you talk about, well, we all love our parents. I can't say that I always loved my parents. And the love that I did have was not healthy. And so what I see, and I'm guilty of this, I do this all the time. I overcompensate with my own children. I shower them with nice gifts and material things when I'm not physically present, because somehow I feel like that I'm allowed to replace my emotional love with physical items. That's not what helps my children. And it doesn't help me. It doesn't make me feel any better. And so when I give my kids all these material things, I want to make sure that those material things are something that are more meaningful. Like, okay, hey, Kimber, who is my oldest daughter, I have a few things that I'm going to drop off to you. Now, dropping off something to my oldest daughter is going down on a 2-hour car ride. So it's not just so convenient to drop something off. But I almost use it as an excuse for a reason to have to go and see her. When she made the most beautiful comment to me, Ma, you know, you can just come anytime you want. You don't have to have something to drop off. That was a beautiful affirmation that maybe I did something right with my children. They know that those material things aren't what they value. It's time that they value more than anything.
Do you feel like that is something that was because you were missing out on material things as a child, or missing out on time as a child? Like, I mean, and even looking at your career now, where you literally are dispensing material items to people on a grand scale, like, I'm not trying to psychoanalyze here, but really looking at it that way, is What do you trace that back to?
I would say yes, and I overcompensate. You know, what's interesting is one of the things I wanted to be most in life was a mom. Being a mom is my greatest accomplishment, and I would do everything exactly the same to feel the joy of motherhood every single moment in my life. And I knew what kind of mom I wanted to be by the example of how my mom was and wasn't. And so I didn't have a good mentor of what motherhood should be, but I knew exactly what I didn't want it to be. So much like my husband, you know, my second husband, the love of my life, besides my grandson, we joke about that. He's my a la carte man. Because of my failed first marriage, who was an abusive man, I knew what I didn't want in that partner. And so much like choosing my partner for life, it was based on past experiences of knowing what I didn't want more so than what I did want.
I resonate a lot with what you're saying, because I feel like for me, looking back at, you know, some of the abuse that I had as a child with my dad and then my neighbor, I wanted a voice. And so now I sometimes overcompensate with the voice without listening. I will be a voice, but I'm not going to listen. And so that is what I struggle in, is making sure I temper that some, because it is like, I see some of the, you know, we say trauma comes back as a reaction and not a memory. And there are things that we do that are very acceptable, especially as women and in performance and things like that. And I see how I didn't want to be a victim. I didn't want to not have a voice, because I didn't have a voice. And I was told to be quiet. And I was told to, we're not going to talk about that. It's already getting prosecuted. And those things that were just subtle in so many ways, but also formed me in a lot of ways. I appreciate that overcompensation piece, because I do it all the time. What would be your advice for those, maybe that teacher or that foster parent or that little girl, Jody, who was in their classroom or in their home?
Listen, you know, it's so funny that you said listening, because I was just with a very dear friend of mine, and she asked me, like, you know, it's the time of the year where you're putting out New Year's resolutions, and so many people now have a word. And she was like, so do you have a word this year that you're going to focus on? I'm like, no, I'm not going to have a word. And she said, she tells me this story. And at the end of the story, she made a conscious decision that her word this year is to listen. The word is listen. And the conversation I had with her was probably a week ago. And I can't tell you the number of times in my day now for the past week that listening has come up. And while I may not profess that I'm going to have a word of the year, I'm leaning into listening. I would say listening in a way not to respond, but to understand. And so to those teachers, I have shared my story with teachers in many different school systems in our community, because when you see an unruly kid or a kid that is disruptive and fidgety in their seat or different things, instead of reprimanding that child, ask the question and listen. Listen to the answer. Listen to what your children are telling you, because in the listening, and maybe sometimes in the gaps between the words, is where you're going to find your answer, is where you're going to find your solution or the support you can offer to those that are in need. I will also share with you, I choose very intentionally to use the word support and not help, because when I help people, I feel like I am taking away their power and their value to do a task on their own. If I can support a person, a task, all I'm doing is giving them a crutch or encouraging them to unlock the power that's already inside of them. And that's another great way of another piece of advice that I would share with those listening today. Listen and support, not tell and do.
I appreciate those words. I especially, you know, I yesterday was teaching at the mission to staff, and they were talking about behaviors, and they have a lot of families with children there, and getting across to them and getting across to people as a whole that behavior is how we move to self-regulation, and how kids especially their behaviors are that's the language of trauma. That's literally the language of trauma. And this is what I told them. I said, there's two things you need to do. Number one, when you see a behavior, especially when you're triggered by it, you need to just in your head say, good, my foot is in the door. Because literally they just spoke to you. They just told you, I'm not okay. I'm hurting. I'm scared. I'm afraid. I'm in pain. Any of those things. And then the second thing to tell yourself is this is not about you. Because we want to assign all the time that behaviors in others, it's about our inability to do something or that we did something or, you know, all those things. And when you can get to that space, then you can actually listen to people because our voices in our head want to tell us they did that to get me, or they did that to manipulate me, or they did that because I'm not a good enough mom, or because I'm not a good enough teacher, or I'm not a good enough whatever. And when we can really get to that space, then we can actually close off all those voices, because listening's not just about hearing your words, it's hearing what you're not saying. And I can't hear what you're not saying if I have already in my mind all the words flowing, telling me what you're doing. So it's an interesting step where listening actually involves stopping yourself in all those voices in your head so you can actually listen to what is not being said, especially in trauma responses. Words don't mean anything. It literally is what is their body telling you and their pitch, tone, cadence, and all those things, because it isn't really about what we always say the issue is not the issue. And most of the time, if you could listen, their story would destroy you. It truly would.
Yeah.
If you can listen what they're going through, you are going to say, oh my gosh, your behavior makes sense in light of what it's happening to you.
Yeah. I just want to respond just very quickly. I am going to be 50 this year, and that number means absolutely nothing to me. It's just another eight. I am as young at heart as I want to be and as old as my body tells me I am. 50 does not bother me one bit. But at the young age of 49, I learned that the trauma that I experienced as a child has created so many positive skills for me. And one of them, and I didn't know this until a couple months ago, that my attention to detail, my ability to see things differently or more openly than most average people comes from my trauma, because I was programmed from a young age that I would scan a room to make sure, am I safe? What is out of place? What is wrong? How is a mood changing? All of those different sort of nonverbal cues, I learned to keep myself safe. Our children, adult friends who are experiencing trauma, have so many beautiful life skills that just need to be unlocked, to allow them to see that while a victim in trauma, their potential to survive outside of it is just waiting for somebody to unlock. And that unlocking can happen on their own or for somebody just to listen and love, authentically love.
Wow. Krista, any questions? Krista always likes to.
Oh my gosh. Oh, love this topic. And I love that because I'm a true believer of, I'm over 50, right? And I'm a true
you
believer.
You are all not 25.
No, I'm way older than you. But, you know, I think you put it right, Jody. We're a thread to each other, right? Like, I would not have heard your story today if it wasn't for Stacy. And I think we all intertwine. And I do a lot of thinking about this because my dad is in a memory care unit. I'm in a support group, kind of like your story with your grandmother. We're all in different journeys, right? And sometimes you get lost. You know, you're supporting each other with those keys and you open those doors. And I can't even tell you the relationships that have opened up. I guess my question to you is, at what point did you really start thinking about keys? Are you now at a point in your life where you kind of like see them coming? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, I can tell you that I metaphorically speaking, never truly made the connection of opening doors and keys until I sat down to write that keynote for the foundation. And because the theme that year was a door and I was delivering the keynote, I wanted to do something that drew people in, but also share something that people didn't necessarily understand. And again, part of my career, part of my work, part of my job, one of the things that I feel like I do really, really well is that I connect generous people to causes they care about. And in order for me to connect people to those causes, one, I have to listen to understand what they want to do, but then I need to be able to provide a pathway for them to deliver a generous gift. But I also, because of my work at the Community Foundation, when a lot of people view the foundation as the, you know, the top echelon of givers, I knew that in that room, because I, you know, I spent almost 16 years at the foundation, I knew that we would have nonprofits in the room and other people that weren't necessarily at a stage in their life where they could give major, major gifts. Every gift that we give is major because we're giving something away. We're giving a piece of us away. And what my hope was with the doors and the keys was to help every person realize the keys that we all hold every single day that will unlock a door for ourselves or for somebody else. And so metaphorically speaking, I think that it was just make, you know, really sitting in that space where I wanted to sit down and write this keynote. And you guys got an abbreviated version of it. There was so much more to it, but I wanted to try and condense it down to make it make sense today. Do I see doors opening or keys coming? I don't know that I see them coming, but I realize it afterwards. And I used to carry a bag of keys around and would sometimes leave them as a thank you gift. But I'm so far removed, it takes a lot of explaining.
I appreciate even what you're saying, where you didn't realize you about the keys until after, because I think about that coach, you know, that really came alongside of you and probably didn't even realize. It wasn't probably a strategic thing of like, hey, I see this kid, Jody, and I'm going to bring her into this program because I'm going to someday she's going to look back and, you know, and do a keynote about me. Right. Like really, yeah. It was just probably like, wow, that kid's sitting here every day after school. She should be doing something. And I think that there's authenticity in that. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's funny about it is Doc Schreiner's in Mishawaka. He is not in the Elkhart County community at all. And there would have been no reason for him to have heard my address. And at that point, I hadn't probably spoken to him in probably 10 or 15 years. I mean, it had been a while. I had arm's length connections. We'd run into each other every once in a while, but nothing ever very intentional. And one of his former coworkers, who was a superintendent, heard my keynote that day and came up to me after and said, hey, I know Bob. He needs to know your story. He needs to know the impact that he made on your life. He probably doesn't even know. He doesn't realize it. And I told this guy, I'm like, well, you know, it's okay. You know, he knows that he made an impact. And Bruce said, no, I think he needs to know. You should call him and you should tell him. And if you don't, with your permission, I will. And so I reached out to Doc and just kind of nonchalantly said, hey, I just wanted you to know that you've really been an integral part of my life and unlocked all these doors. And he was like, because I needed you and I took advantage of your free labor, like you're going to put me on a pedestal and completely downplayed it, you know? But, you know, in his mind, Stacy, he was not helping me. He was helping himself, but it still turned out to be this beautiful, great thing for me.
But himself was just being a good and honest guy, right? Like, and yeah, something that you hadn't seen. And so I do love that. It doesn't, there's not this thing of being, I intentionally have to go out today and give keys out or open doors for people or do this. It's how you live. I think that that's, I don't know. I think there's some beauty in the simplicity of that. And I think the authenticity of that, right? It's not a constructed program, is I guess where I'm getting at. It's a being a good, kind human being and being open to seeing someone that's just sitting after school doing nothing, being open to seeing someone in the community that has the time. So I don't know.
Krista, I want to add one more thing to your question as I'm sitting here a little bit. I think that in order for the authenticity to be there, if we perceive a key ahead of time, I don't think that we're going into it authentically. It's in those moments that we don't even realize it that really provide the passion and the power of unlocking that potential.
You know, back to the coach, to Doc, you just know that letting everybody know that they make a difference, right? Just the way he responded to you, you know that you made his day and that he appreciated that, right? So, and I guess not the preconceived, but just, I know for me, I have to take a look around me and go, look, I'm not, just so that you don't go into this weird space during hard times, looking around you, like you said, and being grateful, because there are people who are trying to be a key for you. And sometimes if you deny them, if that makes sense, right? So it's not preconceiving, but you may be passing up an opportunity. Let's just say you didn't go to grandma's. Let's just say you didn't want to go there. You know, that opportunity may have never, that would have changed your whole journey in life, right? So it's just when you look at it, it's just, I love it. I love this.
I am going to encourage all the listeners out there to be open to listen and open to authenticity, not out there looking for keys, but recognizing when you do, like, okay, that's it didn't happen because you orchestrated it. I think it's just being willing to be available and listen. And I, Jody, your story is just, thank you for sharing and your vulnerability and sharing. And I love at the beginning when you talk about people look at you and they see this woman who's married to a judge and she's an executive and she's done all these incredible things and so well-spoken and so polished, but yet your journey hasn't been those things. And I think that's so important because it makes you real, honestly. It makes you someone that I feel like I can talk to and share with and be not judged with. Thank you. And Trauma for Breakfast listeners, I hope you were just as touched by Jody as I have been. And I know Krista, the producer, has been. And thank you for joining us. And we'll see you next episode.
We're so thankful that you all shared in today's conversation. We are always here and ready to set one more place at the table. Thanks for joining us on Trauma for Breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is brought to you and supported by Matt Force, working together to reduce substance abuse, and Yavapai County Community Health Services, working toward healthier communities.